Okay, so we are recording. It is September 15th, 2020. My name is Maxwell McClure. I'm here with Dr. Dara Orbach, and we are going to be talking about her work with cetaceans and reproductive ecology. Before we start the interview, Dr. Orbach, do I have your permission to record the interview?
You most definitely do.
Awesome, awesome. All right. So I guess the first thing that we can talk about is sort of your early life and like what got you into marine biology.
So it's interesting because the majority of marine mammal researchers, since a young age, have known they want to work with dolphins or whales or seals. And my story is very different. I'm Canadian, so I'll drop some of boots every once in a while. And I grew up in Toronto, which is a very big city by lots of lakes, but not near the ocean. And I went to my undergrad, I was at University of British Columbia, which is in Vancouver in Canada, so very close to Seattle, Washington. And that's a 6-hour plane ride away, right on the ocean. The campus is a beautiful peninsula right on the ocean. And I fell in love with a way of life. I really enjoyed the idea of a place where people would bike to work in their business suits and where people would have picnics during their lunch just because it's a beautiful day outside, and this whole mentality, which seems to be prevalent in coastal cities. And so for me, my decision to become a marine biologist was not so much driven by the animals themselves as the lifestyle and finding a place where I'm in my zen and my happiest and being the most productive because I have the greatest work-life balance and enjoy myself the most. So that was really what got me there. The reason I eventually became a marine mammal biologist, it was not the most direct route. Again, I didn't know it's what I wanted to do. And I was doing two bachelor degrees simultaneously, one in classic Near Eastern and Religious Studies, a Bachelor of Arts, which is very different, and one in Bachelor of Science in Animal Biology. And when I, in my third year of university, or my fourth year, because it took me 4.5 years to do two bachelors, I did a field course, and I really enjoyed field work. And I found that was my first experience doing field work. It was in the Yukon. And I just really enjoyed designing my own experiments. And so in my final year, I did a directed study, like an honors project, where I did some diving duck physiology. And again, that was a wake-up call for me that I really enjoy doing research. At that stage, I didn't think I had the qualifications to do a master's degree with marine mammals, as so many marine biologists started at a much younger age in high school already, and they're often volunteering or interning every single summer. And I just didn't have that background experience. So I took a very unusual route, and I decided to do a master's degree looking at bat echolocation, thinking that acoustics is a transferable skill set. And we know so much more about acoustics and echolocation in bats compared to what we know about in cetaceans, which are dolphins, whales, and porpoises. So the idea was to do this, to learn a skill set that I'd then be able to apply towards the marine mammal world. And it turns out that I don't enjoy acoustic analysis very much, but it got my foot in the door, and I can talk more about that perhaps at the later question, but that was sort of how I transitioned into marine biology.
Okay.
It was knowing that I wanted to always live by the coast. I enjoy teaching. I enjoy traveling. I wanted to amalgamate these things together. And to me, studying animal behavior and animal biology of a marine mammal would guarantee me that coastal lifestyle.
Okay.
Okay.
Great, great. So what was your grad school experience like then? You said that you did that acoustic research in grad school, right? And
Yep, so
that
I
was
did a
with
master's and
bats.
a PhD. My master's was in the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario. And that project itself was looking at flight mechanics, acoustics, and sensory modality integration. I basically tried to understand why bats crash into stationary objects by looking at their echolocation. And I built a bunch of obstacles in their natural environment where they fly through during their mating season called swarming season. And they were different opacities and different lighting conditions, and basically tried to figure out at what point they collided with these objects, how they use echolocation and vision, and at what distance. And that was okay. I liked having the liberty of designing my own experiments. It was really roughing it. We were in the middle of nowhere, Ontario, camping. There was an abandoned mine nearby with some water. We would just put our food in plastic bags and bury it in the mine instead of having a fridge. We used a generator at nighttime to recharge our equipment, but we had to wait for it to rain to have a shower. It was really, really roughing it conditions.
Yeah.
So that was an experience, to say the least. It built some character. But I also had an opportunity. So I was studying bat flight mechanics, and essentially they have their offspring inside the month of June, give or take. And what's unusual about bats is that they fly with their babies on their backs, and their babies can be up to 25% of their body mass, which is incredible if you think about it.
Yeah.
But you would intuitively expect that they would collide into objects if you're flying with an extra quarter of your body weight on you. So it didn't make sense to collect data during that month. And my master's advisor recommended to me during that month that I go to Israel and help teach a field course, which he had taught for several years in the summer. And at that particular location, the field course was on bats. And at that particular location, they had done the first alcohol studies where they gave the bats choices of fruits. These are fruit-feeding bats. And they had a choice of which food to pick based on the amount of alcohol content in it. So I kind of put two and two together that I studied flight mechanics and decision making. I can combine that with alcohol. And so when I went to Israel, I designed a study where I got the bats drunk and fed them alcohol and then flew them through a flight chamber and saw how they collided with objects.
Wow.
And if they slurred their speech, so to speak. So I was looking at their acoustics and their actual flight mechanics.
Wow.
Which went really, really well, and actually won us a grant to send the whole lab to Belize to do a similar experiment looking at many species of fruit bats.
Wow.
And that, as you can imagine, is one of the first alcohol studies on animals in natural conditions or in the wild. Got a lot of media and a lot of publicity, which put me at a huge advantage in terms of applying for a PhD working with mammals, because I had experience in acoustics, I had published, I had supervised other students, I had led field projects, so it really set me up for success. So my master's thesis itself, I lost interest in it relatively quickly, which sounds terrible, but that alcohol study, which was just a side project, became just as much of my time and fascinating to me, and really having that balance of working on multiple projects at once and these leadership opportunities was an amazing experience that helped me develop skill sets that I used throughout my academic trajectory.
Okay. Wow, great. So basically, your work with bats sort of transitioned you into marine mammalogy then. And that was your PhD whenever you transitioned to marine mammalogy? Or
so my PhD was with marine mammals.
Okay.
And shortly after I finished my master's with bats, I knew I wanted to switch to marine mammals, but the end goal had always been marine mammals so that I could live by the coast. If I were to work with fisheries, I might land up by lakes, and I really wanted to be by the ocean because that is my happy place and where I thrive and am able to be the most productive because I just feel more at peace with myself. So I attended a conference shortly after finishing my master's. Every 2 years, there is a Society for Marine Mammalogy conference.
Mm-hmm.
And that one happened to have been in Canada, like a 10-hour drive away. And I said, I'm just going to go. And I contacted in advance several prospective PhD advisors who studied acoustics. And I had arranged to meet with them there. And while at the meetings, I went to their talks and found them very dry, and I was thinking there's no way that I could spend 6 years studying acoustics. I mean, there's a way, but I wouldn't be happy.
Yeah.
So I was feeling a little discouraged because I really, and I will say that most cetacean researchers actually do acoustic analysis. It's one of the most common things to do, and it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it wasn't as interesting as actually interacting with the animals themselves. Looking at sounds on a computer didn't appeal to me anymore. So I wasn't as excited about the prospect of an acoustic study as I should have been. But I happened to have walked into some other talks, and I heard one about dolphins and mating and how almost nothing had been known about dolphin mating in the wild and all the logistical challenges. And at the end of the talk, the student mentioned that dolphins have these really weird structures of their vaginas, and maybe they have something to do with sexual selection in some way, or a way to control paternity.
Mm-hmm.
And being the lateral thinker I am, I thought about a seminar I had heard in my master's about spiders and sperm dumping, and the idea that the male can tap on a female and force her to ejaculate sperm from a rival male.
Hmm.
And this made me think maybe these vaginal structures are also a way for females or males to control paternity after copulation. So post-copulatory sexual selection,
okay.
Which we don't know that much about from the female perspective.
Yeah.
And so I pitched the idea to that student's PhD advisor, and he loved it and said, this is a really outside-the-box idea. And I will mention that I love going to conferences, I love networking, I love learning new information.
Mm-hmm.
But it can get kind of tedious because often it's the same question over and over and over, and they change the location or they change the species, but there's not as much innovation as one would hope. And so he was very excited that this was something brand new, way out there, questions that hadn't been addressed before. So I also was very fortunate that my PhD advisor, Bernd Versig, is extraordinarily famous in marine mammalogy. He's the one who is attributed with discovering photo ID of dolphins, which is the main way to know dolphin abundance and distribution, taking photos of them, which your wife does all the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So he's the one who discovered this.
Really? Wow. I didn't know
and
that.
Usually when he goes to conferences, there's a line of students waiting outside the bathroom just to talk with him and to shake his hand and meet him. And as it turned out, he got sick just before the conference and didn't attend. And so I was the only student that I know of who sent him an email pitching an idea. So it was really a matter, I know it's wrong to be grateful he got the flu, but I'm so grateful he got the flu. Because it really was a matter of right place at the right time, that I happened to have walked into that room, that I happened to have gone to that seminar on spiders and put these ideas together. That I decided to attend the conference, that I had this skill set in acoustics that I had published already, that I had dealt with media, that I had supervised students. It really was a combination of all of these past prior experiences and timing and mostly hard work that poised me to get into my dream PhD, which is where I finally got to do research on marine mammals.
Yeah.
So the PhD was in Galveston, Texas, so not too far from us over here, just a 3.5-4 hour drive away.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent much of my time in New Zealand where I was filming the dusky dolphins there and trying to understand more about their mating patterns, and then got very involved in dissecting reproductive tracts from marine mammals from all over North America. I get them sent to me in Galveston and would dissect them and look at their weird vaginal structures and try to quantify them and look at variation across species, within species, across age classes by population. So really trying to understand this coevolution of anatomy and behavior and how we can use anatomy to predict what mating would look like in the wild, and also understanding coevolution of mating strategies between males and females. And that interface of coevolution between the sexes and also between pre- and post-copulatory is very rare to see applied to an animal, to look at such a broad view of coevolution. So that was really exciting for me. And it turns out that cetaceans, which again are dolphins, whales, and porpoises, have the most diversity in their reproductive tracts compared to any other clade of mammal that exists. So they have this insane level where the number, shape, size, positioning of these vaginal folds differ across species. And I'm at a very unusual point in my career where when I get sent a reproductive tract, I can tell you what species it is just by looking at it. They are that distinctive. And I have gotten samples sent where someone told me it was species X, and I opened it up and said, it's not right. Are you sure you got your data correct? And they said, oh, you're right. We actually sent you the wrong data. It's species Y. So the reproductive tracts are that distinctive, and I don't know if it's something to be proud of, but I know them well enough that I can tell what a species is just by vaginal morphology.
Wow.
Which, as weird as that sounds, in insects, a lot of the way that a species is identified by looking at their penis morphology.
Okay.
So using genital morphology to identify a species is not unheard of before. It just is a little unusual to do in a mammal.
Right. And when you were in, it was in San Francisco, right, that you studied harbor porpoises, Right. I did a little bit of research into some of your articles, and I found one of them that talked about there was like a correlation between like there's like a leftward bias with like the with the penis and the vaginal shape, right? And that's correlated to the way in which they mate. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, so San Francisco is one of my other main, so New Zealand, San Francisco, Texas, Canada, I'm all over the place. I get to travel a lot, which again was one of the goals of an academic career. So I'm fortunate that in addition to Kaikoura, New Zealand, one of the only other places where we can see cetaceans mating under natural conditions regularly at the surface of the water is in San Francisco. So San Francisco Bay is hourglass-shaped, and the narrowest point is actually right underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. And the porpoises there realize this. So every single day, their food moves in and out of the bay with the tide. So at high tide and low tide, every single day, they cross underneath the bridge at these exact periods relating to within an hour of tide. And because it's the narrowest point, males know that if they hang out underneath the bridge, they're likely to encounter a female who's passing by chasing after her food. So if you stand on the Golden Gate Bridge at high tide and look down, it's pretty often that you will see a splash, and that was actually a porpoise mating. The whole event is less than 2 seconds. It is aerial, where the male leaps out of the water. The female has no idea he's in the area. She's swimming along. A male will come chasing from far away, dive deep, and then come up leaping out of the water at such force that he knocks her out of the water most of the time. And his penis extends all the way to his chin, so it's 3/4 of his body length. And while in the air, in less than 2 seconds, he has to wrap his penis around the female into her reproductive tract. So his belly is towards her back, and his penis is so long, it wraps around her body, inside her, inseminates, and then he lands in the water and she dives, and it's all in like blink of an eye. It's pretty amazing. And it turns out, in watching, spending, and it's mostly my colleague, Bill Keener, who did most of the work, but in spending hours on the Golden Gate Bridge over the course of several years, we collectively documented about 200 events of harbor porpoise mating, and both on video and on camera. And in every single one of these events, the male is on the left side of the female. So every single time when they actually make contact, he's on her left side. And so there's this laterality in sexual approach, which has never been documented before in any mammal. And it's very, very unusual. So me being a reproductive morphologist, I started to think about, well, maybe the reason for this laterality has something to do with the reproductive tracts and coevolution. And so we dissected several female reproductive tracts, and we basically measured all the bends to the left and to the right created by these vaginal folds. They create a vaginal labyrinth, essentially. And we also inflated the penises of dead animals to look at the natural kinks in their shape and compare those to animals, photos we've taken of live animals with their penises extended. And it turns out that there is an optimal approach that the male has to take for his penis to bypass all those vaginal folds and get close to the cervix. So the idea being, the deeper the penis can penetrate, the shorter the distance that sperm is going to have to travel to fertilize the eggs, and the more likely he is to gain paternity. So that's exactly what we found, that for the best, deepest possible penetration, the male has to approach the female from her left-hand side, and he has to approach her with his belly towards her back. And in any other position, the penis will not penetrate very deep. So it turns out the genital shape has co-evolved with this behavior. And it's a chicken and egg discussion. What came first, the behavior or the genitalia? Was it the female labyrinth? Was it the penis that came first? And these are very difficult questions to answer. But there does seem to be this amazing co-evolution between anatomy and behavior and both sexes as well.
That's
So that's
fascinating.
something I'm always really excited about. And my colleagues and I, who are at the, they weren't formerly at the Golden Gate Cetacean Research Center, and now they're at the Marine Mammal Center. We're working on collecting photos and videos of harbor porpoises mating from around the world. And there's not that many documentations. I think we have maybe 15 so far from other or 15 other locations. And it seems it's always left-sided in those locations as well. Which is really interesting. So this is not just a population-specific pattern. this is a taxa-related pattern that seems to be ubiquitous across them.
Yeah. Was it difficult to observe them in some certain months? Because I've been to the Golden Gate before, and it was in like June or July, and it was like very foggy there at that point in time. There was like no visibility. How did that kind of work with your study?
There definitely are very difficult months. Also, high tide might be at 4 in the morning, and at 4 p.m., where it already is after dark in the winter. So it's not
Yeah.
always possible to get out there. So a combination of the right weather, tide being at the right time, if the sun's too high in the sky, you could also miss them. So we did capture mating in every single month of the year, but there were certain months, particularly the foggy months, where it was much more challenging to obtain that data. But they do seem to mate year-round.
Yeah. Okay. Could you talk more about your work in New Zealand as well? And that was with dusky dolphins, correct? And you guys used what was it? It was UAVs, right? It was a sort of a new sort of approach to studying them that kind of helped out.
Yeah, so we went in 2017 in December back to New Zealand to Kaikoura, and we used UAVs, which are unmanned aerial vehicles or drones, to film dolphins in different contexts. So we were filming them in nursery groups, we were filming them in mating groups, and we were filming them in large pods. And my research, the part I'm interested in was largely in the mating groups. And so there's different, in general, dusky dolphins in Kaikoura, there's about 2,000 present at any given time out of a national population of 10,000 dolphins. So they're constantly leaving the area and coming into the area. And they tend to form these very, very large pods with about 100 to over 1,000 dolphins present. And then there are smaller satellite groups nearby as well. So there's these different group types. And we sometimes see mating inside these larger groups, but for the most part, they form these smaller satellite groups. Everything's beeping at me at once. I'm very sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
Turn off everything beeping. Tell it to stop. Phone is on silent. Everything's going to stop beeping now. Okay. So what's unusual about Kaikoura and the reason it's possible to film their mating there is that there's a very deep canyon that comes within a kilometer of shore. And it's a highly productive area because there's the convergence of several different waterways. So you have warm and cold waters converging, lots of primary production, secondary production. And the dolphins are very opportunistic foragers that they feed on the mctophid layer of squid and lanternfish, which have a daily migration pattern. So every day, those fish, migration is not necessarily horizontal in the ocean, it can also be vertical. So it's called a dial. A movement pattern, but they migrate every single day. These are the fish and squid inside the water column. They go up towards the surface of the water late at night. And the dolphins are opportunistic that they wait till the fish and the squid are as close to the surface as possible, and that's when they dive down to forage. So they don't hold their breath, but they don't have to work as hard, they don't have to dive as deep. So they're very opportunistic. They're feeding only at nighttime. Which means the daytime, I don't believe they've ever been observed foraging during the day, which is also very unusual for a dolphin. And we know that just 200 kilometers north at our other field site, the same dolphins that we see in Kaikoura feed in the day in our other field site. So it's specific to this area that they are opportunistically using the environmental conditions and the ecology to facilitate their feeding. So they can feed in the day, but they don't in Kaikoura. And that leaves a lot more time for other activities like resting and traveling and socializing, and especially mating. And during the austral summer, which is October through February, there is a lot of mating that occurs. It occurs at the surface of the water. It is very high speed. There's typically four males chasing one female. They engage in scramble competition where they're essentially trying to get a position close to that female. And line up their body with her. They're not very aggressive towards each other. They're not very aggressive towards the female, but they're very agile, rapid, fast-paced chases. And the female behaviors are extraordinarily evasive. She's doing everything she can to get away, including diving deep, leaping through the air, abruptly stopping and changing directions, constant direction changing, flapping her tail. So all of her behaviors are evasive, and all of the male behaviors are very aggressive in terms of their persistence. So you have these chases which can persist for maybe 10 minutes at a time, and then they break apart and the groups form back together and new dolphins move together, but they're typically in these smaller groups. And so we flew the drone over these mating groups, and we are trying to understand their behavioral patterns and to compare those to mating that occurs inside these megapods or these very large pods. And my thought was that if you're in a group of dolphins with like 500 individuals present and you're mating, there's lots of dolphins in the area. You can't move around very much because there's so many dolphins around. It probably is more of a social function than a sexual function. Whereas in the mating groups, I thought it would be more of a conceptive function. So something unusual about dolphins is that they're one of the only groups of animals that mate year-round, even though they can't possibly conceive. So we know that bonobos, humans, a few other species also do that. But for the most part, animals only mate when the female is in estrus and there is the possibility of conception. Whereas in dolphins, they mate all year round. We see a lot of homosexual mating as well. So mating cannot, it can serve other purposes. It might be for fun. It might be to build dominance relationships, a way to work out dominance hierarchies. Mm-hmm. It could be for social bonding. It could be practice and learning. There's a lot of reasons why an animal might mate besides for conception. So we filmed the drones over the two different groups, and we actually found very few differences depending on the context. And we found that our numbers were also very similar to what we collected in the past doing boat-based surveys where we didn't have the drones. But what the drones offered, which was amazing, is the ability to see behaviors a lot better and pick up more subtle behaviors, and also the ability to track individuals. So we can see an individual over repeated different behaviors that they're performing, and in theory, understand how things like a male's body size or how a particular behavior might lead to him being more successful in gaining a copulatory position.
Yeah. Okay. And your study itself, was it funded by National Geographic? I thought I saw something like that on one of the articles.
Yes. So, oh my gosh, my emails are exploding. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. It's good.
I don't know if you can see my screen, but I think it's on the recording, so I'm sorry for that. I don't know how to disable the
email. Oh, that's okay.
We were fortunate that my PhD advisor, Bernd Versig, won a scholarship from National Geographic to fund the research on mating behavior that I did throughout my PhD. And I also had won a NSERC, which is the Canadian equivalent of an NSF grant. So I had won that at the PhD level, which also helped fund that research. And Texas A&M University at Galveston provided a lot of small funding as well. So a lot of our funding came from the university, federal funding, National Geographic. And it was wonderful to have that sort of opportunity to do that exploratory work on dolphins. And we are grateful to all of our funders.
Yeah. Definitely. Did they do like any like recording like for any of their shows or anything of that sort? Or was it just like a funded study?
That one was a funded study, but there was a documentary called Sex in the Wild that Windfall Farms, which is like a BBC station in the UK, did a documentary about mating in four different groups of animals. One was elephants, I think one was primates, and one was cetaceans. And for that video, they came to New Zealand. They spent 2 weeks there filming the dusky dolphins on the boat with us, with me talking about what we were doing. And then they also flew to San Francisco and did some work on the harbor porpoises there as well, documenting, again, some of these mating behaviors. And I believe in that project, they also were fortunate to witness a dolphin giving birth in the water and did some sperm behavior and something with gray whales in Mexico. So that was a doc, and I also am a finalist right now for a grant with the Explorers Club, which is pitching the ideas to Discovery Channel. And the goal of this current grant is that they want to make a documentary out of the recipients. So if I do, I think I'm in the top five choices right now. So if I do win the grant, this research that we're proposing to go back to New Zealand and do some energetic and physiology research that would become a documentary of some sort sponsored through Discovery Channel.
Wow, that'd be awesome. Would you say that New Zealand was one of your favorite places that you've gone to, or do you have any other favorites?
I love to travel. It's my favorite thing to do.
Yeah.
And besides taking pictures of sunsets on the ocean, and I'm usually lucky that I've been to 46 countries, so cool. Travel is really my passion. So I do have a lot of favorite places in the world, but Kaikoura is definitely one of my top ones. It is a piece of paradise of this rugged beauty. It just is a stunning landscape where I say you can't take a bad photo there. It's like Iceland. You just cannot take a bad photo because it's so beautiful everywhere that you go.
Yeah.
And it's really special because the dolphins there are so acrobatic that it's a great opportunity to get photos of leaping dolphins, which is always really wonderful, and they're very charismatic. And I think on my best day on the water, we saw 9 or 10 species of marine mammals, which is also almost unheard of anywhere in the world. It was a really, really good day.
Wow.
But Kaikoura is such a... Kaikoura means tasty seafood. It's known for its its productivity, and it's also very well known for its sperm whales, that there are sperm whales there year-round. Young bachelor sperm whales move there on their way towards migrating towards the poles and separating. So it's known for its sperm whales. It's known for its New Zealand fur seals. It's known for a waterfall that unfortunately got wiped out during the last earthquake. At this waterfall, there were a bunch of baby fur seals that would leave their mothers at the rookeries and go through like tunnels and get to this waterfall. And it was just an area where little baby fur seals would be jumping through waterfalls. It was like the most amazing place in the world.
So, wow.
That was definitely one of my favorite places to practice photography.
Yeah.
So New Zealand to me is a very special place. I call it one of my homes, one of my favorite homes, and I miss it dearly. And the dusky dolphins there are just so charismatic. There's Hector's dolphins there, which are an endemic species to New Zealand, which are also endangered. Mm-hmm. They're very, very small. They're one of the smallest species, and they have these like Mickey Mouse ear-shaped fins. So there's just, we saw orcas there. We saw humpback whales there. Just an amazing, amazing place for viewing marine mammals and for connecting with nature. And the people there recognize how special their environment is. They're very respectful of their animals. The Maori culture there also is very involved in animal takes. And so it's a really wonderful community that works together in terms of all the dolphin watching, the whale watching, the researchers. People work together and are really interested in conserving these animals and promoting ecotourism in a safe and sustainable way.
Okay.
So it's somewhere I would highly recommend people go should they have the opportunity.
Definitely. I was actually going to ask about their environmental regulations over there. How are they compared to, like, say, for example, if you were to study something in the U.S. in a region here, how would that compare to studying in New Zealand?
So in both cases, you need permits from the government.
Mm-hmm.
In both cases, for a drone permit, you need to have an operator who has extensive experience, who has specifically a pilot's license and has extensive experience flying over marine mammals. So they do take their regulations very seriously. And the distance that you can get towards those animals is also regulated. So for the most part, these are protected mammals. It is illegal to harass them in both countries. People care about them. Something interesting about Kaikoura specifically is that there was a land-based study where they were observing how interactions with the animals, both the sperm whales in one study and the dusky dolphins in another study, how interactions of boat traffic with them affected their behaviors. And when it turned out that there were some effects, the locals voluntarily changed their boating schedules to accommodate these animals and to protect them. So in New Zealand, or in Kaikoura, there was it's a mandatory, but it's voluntary, rest period where between 11 and 1 p.m., I'm pretty sure those are the hours, there's a 2-hour period in the middle of the day where they find the dusky dolphins are resting the most. And so the boats do not approach dolphins during that period. They leave them alone to rest. And it's sort of known that it's a social faux pas of the area to harass a dolphin when they're resting.
Yeah.
So for us, it was always really special because we would launch our boat in Kaikoura, and then the places we could go might be 25, 30, 40 kilometers away from where we launched the boat. And for a long day in the water, it was too far to travel all the way back to come back again in the afternoon. So we would just cut our motor at 11 p.m. and have a two-hour lunch break siesta. And oftentimes we'd spend the whole morning looking for dolphins and couldn't find the ones we were looking for. And it seemed that as soon as it was rest period and we would cut our motor, that's when they would come right by the boat when we couldn't take photos or harass them. So
yeah,
they didn't read our protocol very well.
Well, cool. So could you talk about kind of like the work that you're doing now here at Texas A&M Corpus Christi?
Yeah, so my work is, my lab is called FABAM, with an exclamation point, Functional Anatomy and Behavioral Ecology of Marine Mammals. So the functional anatomy part is a continuation of my PhD and postdoc research, trying to understand more about form and function of genitalia, how it's co-evolved. Some of our research, for example, I have a PhD student who just started who's going to be looking at sperm properties that are collected using a biomimetic synthetic vagina to understand if you get a better quality of ejaculate mm-hmm. when you use an artificial reproductive tract that simulates the natural elasticity and shape of a natural vagina. So we have some aquarium that will be using that for voluntary semen collection. Mm. We'll be artificially inseminating some dead animals as well. So a lot of work understanding semen characteristics. We were meant to go to Iceland but with the honors program, but it got canceled due to COVID. But we were going to go to Iceland. They have the phallological museum there, the penis museum, mm-hmm. where they have the world's largest collection of penises from mammals. I happen to have the world's largest collection of marine mammal penises in my lab on campus.
Wow.
If they have the world's overall, it's a weird thing to brag. But
yeah, yeah.
They have the overall words. They have every mammalian species that occurs in Iceland. They have a sample of its genitalia. Please stop beeping at me. Okay. This one I can't turn off, unfortunately. So they had kindly allowed us to come there to take photos. And more than photos, we have a 3D scanner. We were going to scan their penises and build 3D models of them and compare the shape of genitalia and look at taxonomic patterns and also how they've co-evolved with female genitalia. And that still is on the back burner for when the national travel or international travel situation changes and it becomes safe to do so. At present, we also have, when these animals first die, the females, before I dissect their reproductive tracts, I will mention that everything I do, whether it's dealing with a dead animal or a live animal, everything is under federal permits. I'm not just going out and harvesting animals. Everything is going through a chain of command and reported to the federal government. So everything is, we're very careful about our permitting. But when these animals, when I first get sent these reproductive tracts in the mail, which are very stinky, before I dissect the female, I actually make a mold of her vagina out of silicone. Mm-hmm. And so that tells me what the lumen of the vagina, what the interior is going to be like in terms of its shape. And we've been able to make 3D models of those and look at the complexity across phylogenetic patterns. So do certain species have more complicated vaginas? Are they closely related? Does it have something to do with their penis shape? So really trying to understand patterns of diversity in genital morphology. So that is one component of my research, looks a lot across marine mammals. So the questions are usually not species specific, like I might do a study like the one we talked about just on harbor porpoises, or I'm about to finish up one on manatees, but most of my patterns are very much so question oriented. And I'll come back to the second part of my lab in a second, but while I'm on this tangent, where we're talking about how I got into grad school and my success route, I think a large part of it is that for me, it was never, I want to study specifically humpback whales in Hawaii. I wanted to live by the ocean and to feel the sand in my toes every day. That was my life goal. And I've really been driven by the questions. So I look at broad questions that haven't been applied to marine animals before. And because I have a background in ducks, in bats, and all these other, with fish, like in all these other animals, I use a very interdisciplinary approach where I take transferable skill sets and methods that have been used on other species and other systems and apply them to marine mammals. So for me, a lot of the joy of my research is being able to come up with very innovative ideas that have never been tested before in marine mammals, because there really is no one else studying functional morphology of marine mammals. I shouldn't say just me, my collaborators obviously are very involved in these projects too, but there's not another major lab in the world which is highly vested in understanding functional morphology of marine mammal genitalia. So this puts me at an excellent advantage that the sky is the limit in terms of questions and ideas, and we really push those boundaries. Like, for example, we take dead dolphin penises and we inflate them with Vaseline and pressurized saline to simulate erection. Or we'll stretch a vagina until it tears to look at its biomaterial properties and the mechanical force it can withstand. So yeah, we really have this sort of carte blanche in the terms of everything's under permits and everything has a biological rationale. There's so many unknowns, we have this amazing opportunity to take the research in different directions. And that's what I love about it, that it's constantly evolving. And for every question we answer, there's 5 new questions that come up. And this is, for me, like the joy of being a researcher is this discovery component to it and understanding these biological patterns. And I'm constantly blown away by how little we know, like some things that we take for granted as being known facts are simply not known. People ask me all the time, if they don't ask me, they tell me, I saw it on a Snapple bottle, is it true that dolphins have sex for pleasure? And the answer is no one's ever studied that before besides for me, and I haven't published that data yet. So
yeah,
whether or not Snapple thinks this is true, like this is something people just assume, but we haven't answered these questions yet. So it's a really fun opportunity where you think about just questions in general, and then especially my postdoc advisor, Patricia Brennan, who is a brilliant mind and also a very lateral thinker. She does reproductive morphology on sharks, on alpacas, on snakes, on waterfowl, all kinds of animals. We have a lot of fun coming up with innovative ways to answer these questions that are way outside traditional standard, here's how you answer this question. We have a lot of fun kind of pushing boundaries or breaking boundaries to do some pioneering research.
Yeah.
So the second part of my research is the behavioral ecology part. So New Zealand, all that research I was doing on mating behavior and how it relates to the environmental conditions like the Deep Canyon, that's behavioral ecology. The water here in Corpus Christi is very murky. With your wife just on the weekend, we saw dolphins mating, and I couldn't even tell you how many dolphins were involved in that mating interaction. So it's very hard to know a lot about behavior here, but we're very interested in understanding their population biology, their demographics, their habitat use, their distribution, their abundance. So the last study here, published study here, was over 30 years ago on how many dolphins are in the area.
Wow.
So it's very outdated in terms of our information on who's here. Are they here all year round? Do they have a preferred area they like to use? What are the conditions? What's the salinity in that area? Is it close to some other element that would appeal to a dolphin? And this is particularly important here in Corpus because of the amazing level of exposure to different anthropogenic and natural disasters. So, for example, hurricanes happen quite frequently in the area. We're talking about building a desalination plant. Fresh water is not good for dolphins. They develop skin lesions, which can basically compromise their epidermal integrity, lead to health complications, and they die from essentially exposure to fresh water. So we need to have these baseline monitoring projects and information there so that should a hurricane hit here, we can understand what is normal and what is abnormal. And so our research here does a lot of boat-based surveys, really trying to look at the population biology all the way from Kopono Bay and the Rockport area down to Baffin Bay. So we have a pretty big span that we try to encompass every few months. And we go out multiple times in successive day periods over the course of 3 months. We'll try to hit each of our regions within 2 consecutive days of each other for each region, so that we can do a capture, mark, recapture study. So we're not actually capturing these animals. We want to be as little invasive as possible, but they have natural markings on their bodies and on their fins. So when we take a photo of these markings, we're capturing them. And when we come back a subsequent day and take the photo of the same animal, we've recaptured them. So this is all by being 300 meters away, taking a photo of a dolphin. We can learn more about how they are responding to potential anthropogenic disturbances and how they're surviving in their area. So this area has a lot of fisheries interaction. We've seen fishermen people feeding dolphins, which is very illegal. They're dredging the area constantly to make it deeper as part of the Panama Canal. There are over 230 plants that back onto Corpus Christi Bay, which has a potential for a lot of contamination in the water and pollution. So these dolphins are very robust that they're able to survive through all these conditions. And we need to understand, are they here year round? How long can they survive? What are their baseline levels? And just in general, there's a critical need, and the government has identified this area as an area of high concern that we just don't know anything about them, and they are exposed to a lot of potential hazards.
Yeah.
So a lot of the research here is taking photos of dolphins and just matching those photos to by matching these individuals and saying, we saw individual X on this date, and we saw the same individual 4 months earlier, that already tells us that they inhabit the area for a prolonged period of time. So just by taking photos, there's so much information that we can garner about their population biology. And we have consulted, our funding is from Texas Parks and Wildlife, so the state is invested in this research. And we've consulted with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, with their marine mammal researchers, to make sure that our protocols are something which will be of utility to them for making management mitigation suggestions. So we're very invested in the conservation of these local dolphins and working with the government on making sure that we're implementing protocols that can be used to help these animals.
Oh, that's great. I never really thought that that so much work goes into into dolphin studies and things of that sort. That's very fascinating.
There's a lot. I mean, it seems kind of crazy that all the hours your wife spends taking photos of dolphins are, it's not busy work. Each photo is a valuable point of data. And this is also one of the reasons that dolphins get so much, they're charismatic animals, and they're always smiling. And I say that even a dead dolphin is smiling, so they seem happy all the time.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of interest in them also, just because the data itself, the photos and the videos, which are data used to answer biological questions, are also very conducive for sharing with popular science and with media. So they've really won the hearts of a lot of people because the science itself is really interesting to do.
Yeah. Wow. What would you say is like one of your favorite experiences working with dolphins?
Oh my gosh, there's so many.
Yeah.
One of my favorites was in New Zealand, and we had heard there was an orca in the area, and I hadn't seen one in the wild before. And so we got on our boat and we were looking, and the Department of Conservation boat was nearby us. And we were on the radio saying, you know, where, somewhere around here. He's saying, it's somewhere around where you are. And all of a sudden it popped up less than 2 feet away from us, scared us. And I can send you the photos after. It's like one of my favorite photos ever. But the person on the Department of Conservation boat took a photo of us. And when I look at that photo, I can still, like, in my mind, hearing my field assistant screaming, oh my God! It was just, like, the most amazing, unexpected moment. It was really, really special for me. These animals surprise us. And we have some amazing days on the water where unexpected things happen that just blow our minds. Like, we had, sometimes they're sad things, but we had one day where we were, and I need to work on publishing this already, but it was the same time I did that 2017 drone work, but we witnessed a group of about 30 dolphins trying to drown a little calf. We witnessed attempted infanticide, and it was heartbreaking to watch, but also so amazing, and no one's ever captured this on drone before in such level of detail and continuous follows. So just observing natural phenomenon really inspires me every single day to keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah. What kind of advice would you give to someone who's interested in doing the kind of work that you do? What would be a good start for them?
So for me, I didn't know this is what I wanted to do. I haven't been interning forever. I was fortunate that I had a very famous master's advisor who opened up a lot of doors and connections for me and gave me a lot of liberties and experience. And I was able to use that, especially that alcohol work just got my name on a map. But not everyone's master's goes that way. So my suggestion is to start applying for internships early. Talk to professors you're interested in working with about being in their lab, about potential hands-on experience you can get. Oftentimes, it's sometimes the grunt work and not so desirable, but you work your way up. And once your foot's in the door, often that's the first initial step to get there. My other suggestion would be to, it's not about, most things in life are actually not about being smart, it's about working hard. So you don't have to be smarter, you have to work harder. So people say to me often, like, oh, you must love it when you get to see all these dolphins. And what I'm thinking sometimes when we're photographing dolphins is that for every hour on the water, that is 5 hours back in the lab analyzing those photos. So it is, I do a lot of 20-hour days. I feel like an 18-hour day is my standard when I'm in the field, and I can do that 18-hour days every day for 4 months. So it is really, really hard work and not for the faint of heart. It's not as glamorous as it sounds a lot of the time. It's exhausting, but it's really worth it. My other suggestion would be, especially in COVID, where so many conferences are online, attend virtual conferences, learn more about what research is going on, reach out to prospective advisors, start early, look into funding opportunities, try winning some undergraduate scholarships even that will make you more competitive for a potential PhD or grad program. But the biggest thing is starting early, so trying to get that hands-on experience. Not waiting to the last minute to ask an advisor to be your supervisor. And when you do write those letters, I get every few days like a very generic letter, which is like, dear professor, and then it's copy paste all about them and is not tailored at all towards what I do. So when you're sending those letters, please stop looking at me. I know I need to change the battery. Okay. When you're sending those letters, make sure that you really put the time into investigating that principal investigator, that researcher, read their articles, talk specifically about why their lab is a good fit for you. They want to know about you, but they're receiving emails from students every single week who want to join their lab. So you need to make yourself stand out and show that you've really put in the time to learn about them, to learn about their research, pose questions about something that their article intrigued you or potential project ideas. So things like that to sort of set you apart, to make you from a good candidate to a great candidate. It's putting in that extra effort that makes the big difference.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then I think the biggest suggestion would also be grad school is a big time commitment. It's not a 40-hour job. It's like an 80-hour a week job minimum. You feel guilty if you have a nap. You feel guilty if you take a day off. You feel guilty when you're sleeping. You always feel like you should be working. A lot of students suffer from imposter syndrome. And a lot of students have very high anxiety too, which is part of parcel with being a grad student. So you need to make sure that you are so passionate about the research you're doing. It has to be a labor of love, otherwise it'll be painful to do. It's got to be something where it doesn't feel like work. You need to really love what you're doing. And also make sure that the lab is a good fit for you. Some supervisors are micromanagers, some are completely hands-off. Some have huge labs and have no time. Some have tiny labs and have lots of time. So take the time to learn about what you would like in terms of the level of commitment you would need or handholding. And handholding meaning, I feel like that's a not the nicest way to say it, but like how much help do you need getting your feet wet and solving problems? How much independence do you need? And doing some research to find out which lab is a good fit for you.
That makes sense. I guess a final question that I have for you then is what's basically your whole schedule like for your future work, given all your work that you're doing at Texas A&M? What's kind of looking for the near future, given COVID and everything? How has that affected all of your work?
So a lot of stuff got put on hold. So New Zealand probably won't happen this year, even if we win the grant, because of COVID. I was meant to go to Florida in last year to collect swabs from dolphin vaginas to do microbiome research. We were meant to go to Iceland. So a lot of the research, international travel is on hold at present. That being said, we still are getting out on the water collecting those photos of dolphins, which is fantastic that we can still do that. And we have such a backlog in photos from the past 5 years that keeps us plenty busy. We have the aquariums, which are gratefully, or we're grateful they're willing to work with us and collect the semen. So there's really no holding back on all that semen analysis research that was planned. And then there's several other projects I can do with dead animal tissue. I mean, so much of my research is working with dead animals that there's not really constraints related to COVID other than social distancing from assistants and we're still able to do most of the post-mortem biological components to the research there as well. And then a lot of it is just, I had a lot of projects on the back burner where I had collected the data and needed a student to analyze it or help with the part, or I had to find the time to just write it up. And I've really used this time to sort of get those things going, or to reach out to collaborators where they had the data and put pressure onto them, let's finish this off kind of thing. So I've used this time very wisely to sort of catch up on life. And the hope is that soon we'll be able to resume. Given this is the new normal, hopefully this won't be the new normal forever and we'll be able to resume travel and research. But I think that most faculty at this stage are working with the data that they have available or data they can collect locally and safely. And I'm very fortunate that I have existing data, I can collect data safely, and I also can collect data both in the field and in the lab these days. So there's no, I don't have an excuse for being lazy.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we finish?
I think your questions were pretty exhaustive and pretty thorough. I guess the biggest point would be that faculty are not as scary as they seem, and they usually are happy to talk about what they do. I'm happy to chat in their office hours and to help you if you have questions, or even if you're not thinking about their research but want advice on how to pursue different routes. I think most faculty would be happy to chat with you and help you where they can. I mean, we all want to see students succeed. And the other amazing thing is that Corpus Christi is wonderful in terms of it being on the ocean for marine biology and having so many opportunities to get involved in research and conservation, volunteering at the aquarium, at the Sea Life Center. There's so many organizations locally where students interested in animals have the opportunity to get a hands-on experience. And I would highly encourage those. And usually it is volunteering and interning at the undergraduate level. It's pretty rare. It's a paid position. But if you have that availability, I would highly recommend seeking it out and getting that hands-on experience to help determine what you like and what you don't like. Like I learned in my undergrad, there's certain things I don't like to do, and I'll never design a project which involves doing these sort of projects. It's just not my wheelhouse and not something that appeals to me. So getting experience, even if it's a negative experience, can still be really value in helping you fine-tune what your ultimate goals are.
All right. Well, I think they'll about conclude it. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I really do appreciate you taking the time to do this interview.
My absolute pleasure, and I enjoyed. I'm sorry I didn't have enough time to hear more about what you're doing, but hopefully we can correspond about that.